Good start, man. It's 12:25.
Good, thank you. All right, my name is Mordechai Yaffe, and I'm very honored to be here today. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful program that was set up, and it was something I really wanted to be part of from the very beginning. I know a number of people in the room, but a number of people I don't. I guess part of the reason that I'm speaking today, what gives me any right to speak, is, first of all, I am a parent. So, I do have my own children, and even though that leaves me as vastly unqualified for this, I also happen to be at the schluss of being a head of a Masifta high school for boys, and I also happen to hold a PhD in clinical psychology, which my wife is very upset that I don't practice, and I tell her I do every day. I just don't get paid for it. What I wanted to do, I always found that whenever anybody is going to present something, have the most interesting title possible, and once you have that, it doesn't matter what you say. So I wanted to talk about what I call the ultimate peanut butter cup dilemma, okay? What is the ultimate peanut butter cup dilemma as follows? And this is going to be somewhat dating to certain people, that in the 1970s, there was a famous commercial on a television. I don't have to still explain what that is, right? Okay, so once upon a time, there were people who actually watched things on a thing called a television, and the way in which they were able to afford it was because they sold commercial time and people had commercials, and one of them was for Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, okay? And it started like this. How were Reese's Peanut Butter Cups invented? So they have a guy walking down the street eating with a spoon out of a jar of peanut butter. And he's going, I love my peanut butter. And then it cuts away to another guy walking down the street, different street, I love my chocolate. And this guy goes, I love my peanut butter. I love my chocolate. And it comes very clear, quite rapidly, that they are coming to what is known in halacha as a Karen Zavis. What that means is a corner. And he's going, peanut butter, chocolate, peanut butter, chocolate. And then, boom, they crash into each other. You get all the a la old, like Batman show, bam, crash, the stars and all the moons and everything is out there. Both lying on the floor, and then you get the little dizzy sign around their heads, right? And he's going, hey, you got peanut butter in my chocolate. And the other guy goes, hey, you got chocolate in my peanut butter. And they both try it. Not bad. Two great tastes in one. And the music goes off. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. So, the fact is that very often you have things that you think don't go together. And when you try them, you find out not only do they go together, but there is an exponential improvement on the original item when you put the two together. We need to understand that in chinuch today, raising a generation of children today is very difficult because there's so many different confusing messages. The fact is that all Torah chinuch, rebbeim, yeshivas, and again, I was a little unclear on the whole thing today, whether I was supposed to be speaking to parents, to educators. I figured I'm speaking to Jews, so I figured that's a good thing. But, again, to be honest with you, I know much more about raising children as a mechanech, as a head of a school than I do as a parent. Ask my wife, she will tell you. But the fact is that all Torah chinuch is an extension of parenting. The Torah doesn't tell us, you shall teach your Talmud. It says, v'shinantam levanecho. It's always about teaching children. Torah teaching, and when I say Torah teaching, I don't mean like learning a piece of Gemara. I mean that all that comes with Torah. Everything is always an extension of what parenting is. It's always about parenting. That is Torah teaching. People like to quote, and it's something I just thought of the other day. It's funny because there are actually some people in the room who heard me say this already, so you'll excuse me, but people love to quote the statement of Chanoch Lenar al pi darko, right? Educate the child according to his way. And really, people understand it today to be that that's supposed to be an indication. There's a hot term today in education called differentiated instruction, right? So that the idea is that we give a tailored instruction to different children as according to their needs. And by the way, don't get me wrong. I think that that's critical in today's education. Probably always was, but it's a very hot topic today of differentiated instruction. But the fact is that people have always said, oh, chanoch l'nar al pi darko, educate the child according to his way, which means that we have to give each child what he needs. Not disagreeing with that. That's fine. But perhaps this can be explained differently. That chanoch l'nar al pi darko, according to his way, you know, the word darko is a contraction of the words derech shalo, his way. Perhaps the his is referring to Hashem. The derech Hashem. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. Educate a child according to Hashem's way. And what does it mean that when we say this, why would we come up with that? Because the fact is, you may think that this sounds like a novel interpretation, but the fact is the Torah says that it's a mitzvah in the Torah, b'halachta midrachav, and you shall go in his ways. In other words, how do we come to any type of relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu? With the being for whom we have no way of contacting him through our regular five senses. What do? We look at the Derech Hashem. We look at where Hashem has been. We don't know where Hashem is. We have no conception of God in of himself. But we see the manifestation of him everywhere at all times. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, al pi derech Hashem. That all midos that we have, when we have... Well, I'm good, I'm great, I was smiling. Where we 8x10 glosses, please. So that when we talk about the midos of Hashem, we need to understand that they are simply the template for all behavior that we as humans are meant to have. Let me give you an example. When we look towards the exemplar of Chesed, Avram Avinu, we say, that outflow, that going out, that's too much. It's one midah. It has to be tempered. So we have Gevura, Yitzchak, we pull back, right? Right? Thesis, antithesis, coming towards the synthesis, Yaakov Avinu, which is Tiferes, or Emes. And the fact is that these are all... the midos that are reflections of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. HaKodesh Baruch Hu is the ultimate Baal Chesed. HaKodesh Baruch Hu at the same time is the ultimate Baal Gevuros. Right? Mi kamocha Baal Gevuros u mi do melach. Right? The fact is that HaKodesh Baruch Hu has both things. And the only way in which one can have that is by integrating the two into Tiferes, which is also the midah of HaKodesh Baruch Hu. This becomes the foundation of an accepted principle in Chinuch Habanim. And that is, and again, another one of those famous phrases that gets thrown out, is dochkin b'smol u'makarvim b'yamin. The idea of push away a child with the left and bring him closer with the right. And again, there's many different pshatim that are said about this. There are many different interpretations. The idea that since it's pushing him away with the left is always considered in halacha as the weaker, so that you're always pushing away. And that you're pulling him closer with the stronger. But perhaps that's not the entire picture. Because the fact is that it's not that you're supposed to sometimes be doing one and sometimes be doing the other. It's an idea that you're supposed to always be doing both. A person that has a parent has to always be cognizant of the fact that both factors need to be in play at the same time. And again, if you want to talk about it in the framework that we just set up, that both the chesed and the Gevura are operating simultaneously, that both things are happening at all times. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. The reality is that today, as both parents and as educators, we're often afraid to use discipline. It's fallen out of place. I mean, I'll admit, I remember when I was first going into chinuch 30 years ago, I would hear people, there were people who actually said that as a Rebbe, no smile until Hanukkah. True, and you're laughing, but it was really out there, right? It was out there. And the first time I heard that, I said, are you nuts? What, we're actors? Is that what it is? I'll tell you, for example, when I used to teach, I taught 8th grade for 13 years. Last time I had a real job. And when I was teaching 8th grade, the very first day, what I would do is I would walk into my shiur and I would say, "My name is Rabbi Yaffe, and that is the last time I'd like to hear those words." And of course, they look at me like I'm crazy. And which is always not a bad thing. If you get the eyes to twitch, it's even better. But I'd say, I don't want to hear that again, because I expect you to call me Rebbe. We're going to learn some Dikduk this year, and Rebbe means Rav Shali, my Rav. And at least for this year, that's who I am for you. Because if we're not having that relationship, then I can't teach you Torah. I can give you many pieces of information, but it cannot be a Rebbe Talmud relationship. Is personal. Torah is always personal. And I'd say to them, "And I have a secret for you. I want you to brace yourselves, because this is going to be jarring to you." I said, "Are you ready?" And they'd all look at me. And I'd say, "The secret is, I am a person." No, really, really, I am. I said, I have a wife, and I have children, and I have a home, and I have feelings, just like you do. So try not to hurt them, and I'll try not to hurt yours as well. I said, "I know, because you guys all think that I was born, and my parents looked at me, held me up, and said, 'Oh, look at the baby. I think we'll call him Rabbi.'" It isn't like that. And I feel it's very, very critical, as a mechanech, that a child sees that we're the same species. That's very, very important. I will tell you that in one of my own areas of research, it was perception of parents as people. Now, you may think that that's obvious, but like, you know, has anybody ever seen when one parent might show some affection for another parent, and hopefully the same couple, just realized it wasn't so grammatical, what are the kids' reactions? Ooh, like, I don't know if you would see it on TV, you'd love it, you know, but if it's your parents, my parents. I remember when I was in seventh grade, my father, Lava Shalom, came to one of my parent-teacher conferences. I think it was like one of the one times he was ever there, and the way it worked in our school at that time is the child, I think what a cruel and unusual punishment to children. The child had to take the parents around from teacher to teacher. Can you imagine? It's just downright cruel. And I remember taking my father over to meet my gym teacher. And with all of the articulation and aplomb of a seventh grader, I said, "You know, Dad, this is my gym teacher, Mr. Cruikshanks," right? And as I introduced poor Mr. Cruikshanks, he did the most unbelievably shocking thing. He put out his hand, he goes to my father, "Hello, Albert, how are you?" And I was, "How do you know my father?" You know, you have to understand, I grew up in a small town in Canada. We knew the names of the cows, you know, and yet, how could you, a teacher, know my father? It's almost as though you're both people, right? And the fact is that what's happened today is that discipline has fallen out of favor. Everybody is so scared that as soon as we tell a child, "You need to do your homework," that they're suddenly going to run off the derech, right? And again, I don't mean to demean the going off the derech problem in the children today, but the fact is everybody's so scared. Everybody's so looking, they're afraid of their own shadows. And so that we always end up tending to overcompensate one way or the other. And the fact is that really what Torah Chinuch wants is for us to create a balance. Let me give you a famous example. The beginning of Sefer Melachim, so David HaMelech becomes old, and Shlomo is still very young, and he has a son, Adoniyahu. And Adoniyahu says, "Ani Amloich, I will rule." And he goes and he sets himself up. Look, he is a prince. He gets runners running before him. He sets himself up. And he drew many people towards himself. Many of the leaders in Klai Yisrael, he drew them towards himself. And so ultimately what happens is that Bathsheba and Nasan and Navi come in and say, "Hey, you promised the Malchus to Shlomo." And he says, "Yes, I did." And he makes Shlomo the king. and Adoniel's stocks fall, and ultimately it's understood that Adoniel is going to have to go, and to which eventually he ends up being killed. And the fact is that Chazal tell us that it was really David's fault. Why? Well, because he was a father. Of course it was his fault. I know that. My wife tells me that. But why is it David's fault? It's David's fault. Because once he had had the horrible interchange in his life with Avshalom, once this happens, David is scared. He doesn't want to distance his child. And the fact is, the Navi tells us explicitly that his father never told him anything. To which Chazal tell us, Hamoneya tochacha mibno mevia lidei misa. If somebody withholds rebuke to his son, he brings him to death. A very, very strong message. And the fact is that when we are raising our children, when we are being mechanech our children, we have to understand that the message of tochacha, when done in a context of love, is what Chazal and what the Torah wants us to be doing. You know, it's interesting. A number of years ago, I went in the summer to Harvard Graduate School, their School of Education. I went to a week-long seminar there, and it was a fascinating thing. A lot of educators. I mean, you think about the people in the room. I mean, people who are responsible for the education of perhaps 100,000 children. It's quite wild, and it was an amazing thing. The first day, this fellow by the name of Professor Chris Deedy got up, and he was talking about integrating 21st century technology into education. And he said, we have a tremendous challenge. We have a tremendous challenge in education today, because the fact is that we are trying to educate children. We are trying to educate children for careers that don't yet exist. I thought that was fascinating. It's an amazing thing. Those of you who are of a certain age will remember that at one time there was a career that was considered, it wasn't a high-paying career, but it was certainly something that was solid, was always going to be there. Typewriter repairman. When I was growing up, if somebody would learn typewriter repair, you were set. Where were typewriters going, right? And you know, I love saying to kids, they typewriter, they go, what? They don't even know what we're talking about. And the fact is that clearly children, young children in school today are going to have to be in careers that haven't yet been invented. That's the way the technology is changing. So the question he asked, I think very insightfully, is, so how do we educate children for such careers? And so he said, we need to teach them critical thinking, we need to teach them comparative analysis, and we need to teach them problem-solving ability. And I sat there and nodded my head, I said, ah, yeah, we have to teach them Gemara. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing that here we have it, that the world is catching up to something that we already know is true. By the way, in case, just a quick aside, in case you're not aware, there are more South Koreans who learn Gemara every day than there are people in Israel. Almost every Korean family has a translated version of Shas, and they teach it because they say, why? Even though most of them have never seen a Jew, they know Jews are smart. And what would it make them smart? It would be their Talmud. And so therefore, they go home and they learn. I'd love to hear Abai and Rav in Korean. I think it would just be fascinating. But the fact is, there are more Koreans who learn Gemara every day than there are people in Israel. It's astounding. But the fact is that what we're seeing is how research is catching up with our values. And I think that's a fascinating thing. It's with that in mind that I would like to move to the next idea. That how do we create this balance in our children? Is it something that has some support out in the world of scientific investigation as well? The reality is that the first way in which we create any balance in our children is by instilling a concept of mindfulness. And by the way, it's a hot term today. You know, people like talking about it. But the idea of being aware of the things around us. In the world of research, it's what's called metacognition. Metacognition very simply means thinking about thinking. And, you know, it's amazing. Like, one of the most famous things you can imagine is that, you know, kids in fourth grade, teacher asks a kid a question, a math problem, and the kid says, I don't know. What does the teacher say? Think. What do you want the kid to do? Huh? Like, what are we asking a child to do? And we say, think. It's an amazing thing because there is a process in order to get to the answer. And if the children don't know the process, then unless you teach them the process, there's no way that they can know it. It's true in terms of actual information. It's true in terms of higher order thinking, thinking abstractly. And it's certainly true in terms of emotions. That you can't just rely on emotions just being out there. It requires thinking about it. It requires processing of it. And again, time doesn't allow us. But the biggest challenge that we have in children, and quite frankly, as humans, I'm going to change that. The biggest challenge we have as humans is moving away from our own egocentricity. That begins as literally from when we're born, when we think there's nothing else in the world. And physically, it's like that. Again, we don't have time to go into it now. But ultimately, it comes out emotionally. I mean, watch any teenager, and you'll know what egocentricity is, right? And the truth is, we try and hopefully grow out of it. I will tell you that the boys in my yeshiva know that the most common thing when a kid comes into my office and has done something wrong, so I'll ask him, so what would you do if you were me? And I have to tell you, you want to talk about deer in the headlights. It's like, what would you do if you were me? So, of course, what would be the teenage adolescent male response to that? I don't know. I'm not you. And I go, oh, yes, I'm aware of that. I know. That's why I want you to think about it, because I want you to take somebody else's perspective. What would you do about this if you were not yourself, if it wasn't you? How would you deal with it? And the fact is that the reason that I ask kids this is not in order because I can't really think of what to do myself. I tell them, believe me, you want to come up with something yourself because I'm much more creative than you are. I can come up with great, very creative answers. I said, but I'm trying to instill within them the ability to start taking the perspective of another. And again, such a thing. When you take the perspective of another, it does not have to mean that it's disciplinary. It does not have to mean that it's harsh. It can very much mean that it's a matter of caring for somebody else, but it's the whole package. And the truth is, when we have metacognition, when we're thinking about thinking, we look at our own processes. And again, I will tell you that there is a certain segment of the population that has a lot of difficulty with this. They're called males. And the truth is, this is harder for men. Women do this much more naturally, much more instinctively. Men, because we just want to, you know, show me the nail and I'll hit it. You know, we don't think about the thinking. Just tell me what to do. Please just tell me what to do and I'll fix it, right? And of course, very often women, my wife, they don't want us to fix this. They want us to be aware how to fix it. And once we do that, it doesn't really matter if we fix it. And again, every woman in here is going, uh-huh, and every man is going, I know. but that's the reality. And the more aware we make of ourselves, the more we can move in this. The fact is that this was identified, it's a construct, a number of years ago, which has also become very popular, which is known as emotional intelligence. So emotional intelligence has had a number of definitions, but I'll tell you that, and I have some handouts afterwards if anybody's interested, that there was some researchers by the name of Salovey and Mayer, who in 1990 defined this as the subset of social intelligence that involves the ability to monitor one's own and others' feelings and emotions, to discriminate among them, and to use this information to guide one's thinking and actions. Well, that makes a lot of sense. In other words, the idea, the more that we can be aware of what are the expectations emotionally in the world around us, well, the more that we can guide ourselves. And the fact is, and again, time really doesn't allow, that this is, they talk about perceiving emotions, reasoning with emotions, understanding emotions, and managing emotions, okay? Well, I know. Where this leads, but I have 5 minutes. So I'm timing myself, I'm pacing. What this leads us to is, was a lot my area of research once upon a time, and that is upon what's called parenting styles. And parenting styles was something originally found in the work of a researcher by the name of Diana Baumrind in the mid-1960s, and that they identified three, which eventually became four different types of parenting. The first was known as authoritarian. Authoritarian was when there would be rigid rules, and that parents would tell their kids exactly what the expectation is, and it was, you know, pretty rough. And then there was the other side, which was actually quite popular in the 1960s, known as permissive or laissez-faire, right? You know, yes, you do what you want, just as long as you're happy, I want you to be fulfilled, right? And the third type was known as authoritative. And authoritative is when there was a balance between the two, that parents had expectations from their children, but at the same time would at the same time be loving and caring to them. There was a fourth category, which is called uninvolved, right? Which you can imagine that the parents are just like not there, they're checked out, you can already imagine. So what were the results of this? The results of this, that was an authoritarian parenting, children would be obedient and proficient, they would be less happy and less socially competent, and let's think about the emotional intelligence. And they don't do well in school, and they have lower self-esteem. Permissive parenting actually caused children to be low in happiness and self-regulation. They would have difficulty with authority, and such children didn't do well in school. You can imagine what the expectations were there. Authoritative parenting tended to produce happy, capable, and successful children. And uninvolved parenting produce disasters. But it's an amazing thing is that authoritative parenting, in others, when you are both having the expectations and yet being caring to your children, produce the best results. Ultimately, this research was expanded to two dimensions, and that really was the dimensions of what was called demandingness and responsiveness. In other words, when parents are coming and making insistence of their children, you have to do this, you have to produce, there's demands. But at the same time, there's a responsiveness. So you can imagine, authoritarian parents were demanding and yet not responsive. Permissive parents are responsive but not demanding. And uninvolved are neither demanding nor responsive. But authoritative parenting were both responsive while being demanding. And this is really what I want to point out, that the research has caught up. This is what Torah Chinuch is. We have to love our children. We have to show our incredible caring for them at all times. But at the same time, as you well know, you'll never find a more uneven relationship at all but as between that of parents and children. A Jewish child, al pi halacha, is not only not allowed to contradict their parent, they're not even allowed to agree with them. In other words, you're not a person who makes a decision here. And that there's the idea of the parent being up there at the same time while they're being tremendously caring. And I would submit that both things produce a tremendous sense of caring and warmth. And that is, in my mind, the concept of Dercho B'Yismo or B'Karbo B'Yamin. It's both things. It's both things all the time. All the time. And both aspects are there. That yes, there are demands being placed on you, but at the same time, it's never a withholding of love. The love is unconditional, but always within a context of expectations. Let me close with the following story. It's a story as a Rebbe, but I believe it fits in just well. It was my first year of teaching eighth grade, and I was given a class that politely could be referred to as challenging. Fact is, if you had ever had any success whatsoever in any aspect, you were in the other class. It's true. And from the outset, I made it clear that I was going to place significant demands on these kids, both educationally and behaviorally. And this seemed to be real news to them. However, I used every opportunity to talk with them about all sorts of things, to use any pretext to take them out as an outing, and we had a real relationship developing. Several months into the year, I made one significant expectation from a boy, and he insisted, "We can't do this. We just can't do it." And naively, I walked right into it, and I asked him, "Why not?" And his reply fairly burst out of him when he screamed, "Because we're stupid, okay? We're all just stupid." I was absolutely shocked, and Baruch Hashem, not speechless. And without missing a beat, I went right back at him. I said, "Who told you you're stupid? How dare you think about yourself that way? I refuse to accept this from you." I said, "Now, it's almost lunchtime. You go out and you come back with a completely different expectation. Now, get out of here." And I thought, oh my gosh, the pain of these children, to be beaten down at such a young age. And I thought, how are we going to recover? As they walked by me, that one boy tossed a crumpled piece of paper onto my desk, and he hurriedly walked out of the room. Hesitantly, I unfurled it, and I surveyed the contents that read, "Dear Rebbe, thank you for not giving up on us like everyone has in the past." This piece of paper remains one of my most prized possessions. Thank you very much for coming. Have a wonderful day.